Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of uncommon intelligence whose briefings are must reading in the Asia Times, published under his nom de plume, Spengler, is our first guest. He is the great David Goldman. He has just returned from China. We're going to ask him a question about that in a moment. But before we get there, I did want to ask you, David, as a man who keeps an eye on all things economic and strategic, to comment on a report that is out today at the Washington Free Beacon by our friend Adam Credo, that Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, has won in the internal slugfest over how to sanction the government of Iran, something President Trump has very much determined to do. Evidently, according to Adam, this idea of decoupling Iran from the SWIFT system is not going to be part of the U.S. sanctions regime. Could you talk a little bit about the SWIFT system, what this decision might mean, if in fact it turns out to be true?
SWIFT is the standard interbank payment transfer system. You can't transfer dollars without it. The risk in using SWIFT as a sanction is that the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese, and so forth will use workarounds, which could reduce America's overall influence in the banking system. So it's always a two-edged sword. We have used SWIFT in the past as a weapon, and the European foreign ministers several months ago declared that they were going to create a clearing mechanism which would allow European companies to bypass SWIFT. So it's really a power struggle with our less than loyal and enthusiastic European allies to try to deal with Iran.
And what would be the practical effect of essentially making the decision that you are referring to there, that we would essentially accede to the European position on this?
It tells me that we're afraid that the Europeans would effectively find means to bypass that and make us look stupid. And that's not good news.
Would it embolden the Iranians and thereby presumably enable them to continue doing the things that we are very concerned about them doing if we were to take this step, as opposed to trying to enforce through secondary sanctions on the Europeans or other means a full cutoff, including unhooking them from SWIFT?
Well, secondary sanctions are extremely effective. The difficulty is that when the Germans and French have declared publicly that they are committed to the Iran deal and they intend to find ways to frustrate American attempts to shut Iran out of the international payment system, there's nothing we can do about it unless we can twist their tails sufficiently to make them hurt and go along with what we're doing. But so far, they've really given us the cold shoulder, and that's disappointing.
But they have, as I understand it, had quite a number of their large companies pulling the plug on Iranian transactions.
Yes, many of them are afraid. It's mixed because many of their companies are afraid of secondary sanctions. In other words, they do business with Iran, they can't do business in the United States. That's a separate issue from the mechanics of being able to make a dollar payment over the SWIFT system.
Understood. But it ties into an overall comprehensive approach to dealing with sanctioning Iran, it seems. David, let me switch gears. Again, our guest is David Goldman. He is the author of How Civilizations Die. He is the managing director of Reorient Group Limited. We have talked from time to time about China and technology and the need for the United States to be upping its game considerably if it does not want to cede, perhaps irreversibly, a critical economic battle spaces to the Chinese. I have been told the past 48 hours that a very near-term decision with respect to one key technology may be upon us, perhaps as soon as the beginning of March, and that involves a technology called 5G. Could you tell us a little bit about 5G and why so much seems to be riding on it, and is that that prognosis of a very near-term decision sound right to you?
5G broadband, as opposed to the 4G that's on your smartphone right now, adds a zero to the speed of what you're doing. You can download a movie in minutes. You can run industrial processes off the internet in a way that you can't now. It opens up huge horizons, and the Chinese have made an enormous national effort to set the global standard for 5G technology. If they do that, they'll lead in hardware, software, and a bunch of applications. It would be a very bad thing. And it's an example of China not simply stealing American technology, which we've accused them of correctly, but also developing their own technology at home. And that's much scarier to me than stealing. If the Chinese can innovate and pull ahead of us, we've got a problem. I don't know what the correct deadline is for 5G, but I think over the next 12 months, if the United States doesn't elaborate our own standard, we will see the Chinese pull ahead of us. There was an initiative at the White House to set a national standard, get the relevant companies together and push something, and it simply stopped dead. Obviously, the White House decided they were in no position to herd the cats in the private sector. That's disappointing and a bit frightening.
Well, it can be, especially if, as you say, this proves to be the sort of central nervous system of the so-called Internet of Things, which we are told is headed our way, whereby everything is going to be wirelessly connected to everything else, all aspects of your life, and to have the Chinese in a dominant, let alone controlling position of such things is extraordinarily ominous, it seems to me. Hey, very quickly, we're going to be coming back to this topic with Kevin Freeman towards the end of the show, but I did want to ask you, as an astute observer of and characterizer of the market, what are we to make of the significant downturn on Wall Street yesterday, if anything? And is the reporting about China's economy slowing a big factor, and should it be?
I'm not sure China is the biggest factor. Goldman Sachs has a very detailed report out this week saying that China is going to continue to grow at around 6%, and that tax cuts, monetary easing, infrastructure spending, and basically a cocktail of stimulative packages will keep China more or less on track. I think that's probably correct. From my conversations with officials and academics in Beijing, the near-term performance of Chinese GDP is not the big issue. However, China weighs very heavily on industrial profits. The Fed's beige book yesterday showed that in almost all districts, industrial companies are reporting an increase in costs from the tariffs that already have been imposed. And of course, there are much more tariffs coming in the pipeline. So by first quarter of next year, we could see a significant increase in prices or reduction in profits because of tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese imports.
And perhaps, Will, for the foreseeable future, this will be something we'll talk to you about, as well as Kevin momentarily. David Goldman, thank you so much for your time today.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a delight to say we're joined by Shoshana Bryan. She has been extraordinarily impactful over some 30 years of experience analyzing and commenting on and helping the rest of us understand the Middle East, and specifically U.S. defense interests and policy options there. These days she does it as the senior director of an important organization, the Jewish Policy Center. She has been a guest with us from time to time, not often enough of late, so it's a great pleasure to say welcome back. It's Shoshana Bryan.
It's nice to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Well, we're speaking in the aftermath of Gina Haspel, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, spending some time with Recep Tayyip Erdogan's intelligence folks, reviewing, we're told, some 7 hours worth of information about the Khashoggi affair, the evident liquidation of a fellow who has been described as a journalist. Seems as though he's also a Muslim Brotherhood operative and perhaps even a Saudi intelligence operative, as best I can tell. But in any event, one who's pretty hostile to the current government of Saudi Arabia. He seems to have met his demise in the consulate in Turkey, that is to say, the Saudi consulate in Turkey. And I'm very interested, Shoshana, in your reading of what the reverberations of that might prove to be, both in the region and specifically with respect to our relationships with the contending parties, shall we say. On the one hand, the Saudis, the crown prince there, Mohammed bin Salman, and Erdogan's Turkey, Qatar, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Iran on the other.
Okay, let's stipulate, first of all, that people should not go around killing their political opponents. But let's also stipulate that people do. Turkey does, Russia does, Saudi Arabia does, China does. People do it all the time. So wipe away what has become the phony outrage of the mainstream media. And then get to the question of why is Turkey so interested? Turkey is operating in this context as the counterweight to Saudi Arabia in the region. Turkey has made an alliance of sorts with Iran, which is strange because Turkey is Sunni and Iran is Shia, but Turkey is not Arab and Iran is not Arab. So occasionally they find their way to each other. In this case, they both oppose Muslim, Arab, Sunni Muslim, Arab, Saudi Arabia. That's the constellation of players. You either want to be on the side of the Iranians or the side of the Saudis. Turkey has chosen Iran. The ramifications are huge.
But before you move, could I just ask you about two other players that I mentioned, Qatar and the Muslim Brotherhood? Where do they fall in that sort of bifurcation?
Qatar is an arm of Iran, weirdly enough, because it is Sunni. But the Qataris dislike the Saudis, have always hated the Saudis, and so they find their bed with Iran. We Americans tend to think Sunnis and Shiites never get along. That's not true. They often have interests that coincide. Ditto the Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood takes money from anybody it can get it from, including Iran, if necessary.
And a lot at the moment, it appears, from Turkey, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, because Erdogan is himself a friend, an ally, and perhaps an operative of the Muslim Brotherhood. So those lines that we think are drawn, not to make a pun, but drawn in the sand in the Middle East, are not as clear as that people want to think they are. Saudi Arabia is prosecuting a war in Yemen. What they're really doing is keeping Iran from establishing a base in the Red Sea. It's hugely important to the United States that Iran not have a base in the Red Sea.
It's bad enough that they control the Strait of Hormuz. You don't want them in the Mandal Bab as well, the choke point on the Red Sea.
That's why Israel went to war in 1967. It was hugely important not to have interference with Israel's southern port, down the Red Sea, out to the Arabian Gulf, off to the Indian Ocean, and to, you know, to whatever. If you have Iran sitting in Yemen, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Egypt, all friends of the United States, could easily be bottled up.
And this is not an academic or hypothetical. As I recall, there was an attack on a Saudi tanker not so long ago, and at which point shipping came to a standstill for a time. At least the Saudis' shipping did it not.
Yes, it came to a standstill. The U.S. has some ships in that region, and they made it clear to the Iranians that if shipping was prevented, there would be a different kind of war. But we did not want to go to war in Yemen, which was probably reasonable of us. The Saudis, since it's on their peninsula, decided they couldn't afford not to go to war in Yemen.
Not just on their peninsula, but on their border, and they've actually had Houthi, Iranian supplied, but Houthi missiles fired at Riyadh and other targets in Saudi Arabia, as I recall.
Yes. Now, as it happens, the Saudis are not very good at prosecuting that war. They've made many mistakes. They've made disastrous mistakes. They don't fight necessarily the way the U.S. military fights, but it is their war. on their peninsula, on their border, against people who are threatening them.
And who are hostile to us, let's make clear. And hence, the Saudis have been given or sold considerable amounts of American military equipment, which they are employing, albeit not terribly effectively, but to some extent, as I understand it, Shoshana Bryan, with U.S. intelligence or other technical support. Is that right?
Once again, Frank, you are one step ahead of me. Because we didn't want to have that war ourselves, because we're tired of war in the Middle East, we were willing to support the Saudis as they have the war. That's the way it was supposed to go. But you are correct. We sell them arms, we give them intelligence assistance, and we try to help them do it better. The Israelis are on the same side. They don't participate. I want to be very clear. The Israelis have nothing to do with the war in Yemen. But as they watch the bottom of the Red Sea, they have a great interest in Saudi success and American success.
And a great interest, needless to say, in countering Iran more generally, not just in the Red Sea. And this brings us to one of those tectonic shifts that I want you to address, if you would, Shoshana. Under Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, we're told, is a moderating force in Saudi Arabia. There certainly has been a more explicit aligning of Saudi policy with that of Israel against their mutual enemy, Iran. To the extent that the Turks, the Qataris, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Iranians are all seeking to weaken MBS, as he's known, Mohammed bin Salman, and or the U.S.-Saudi relationship, is there not a danger for Israel as well that there will be repercussions arising from this Khashoggi affair that could be quite counterproductive, as they see it?
There are potential ramifications for Israel, but they are not nearly as big as the ones for Saudi Arabia. Iran is already in a state of war with Israel. Turkey almost might as well be in a state of war with Israel. From the Israeli point of view, if they lose Mohammed bin Salman, what can they do? Does it affect them physically, specifically, militarily? Actually not.
But we have heard reports that Benjamin Netanyahu has been making much of the fact that, for example, civilian aircraft, that is, have been given overflight rights in Saudi Arabia, and presumably that bespeaks a willingness to have other kinds of aircraft transiting Saudi airspace too, if need be, something that's been bruited about for a long time. And the question is there likely to be a weakening of this relationship that could benefit specifically the Iranians and therefore be to our detriment as well, as you see it?
It is to our detriment if the Iranians are stronger. It's also to Israel's detriment. One of the interesting things about Saudi Arabia at the moment is the dislike of Iran, the fear of Iran, the hatred of Iran goes all the way down. And so, yes, Mohammed bin Salman has been a good partner to Israel in that regard. Israel has been a good partner to him in that regard. But where Israel stands to suffer the most is if the war in Yemen results in an Iranian base at the south end of the Red Sea. The rest of it is probably manageable, not well, but manageable, because the fundamental Israeli interest and the fundamental Saudi interest, no pun, is the same.
Interesting. Let me turn to another piece of this picture that you focus on as the editor of In Focus Quarterly at the Jewish Policy Center, Shoshana Bryan, and that is the idea that is now being bruited from time to time by President Trump, that his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has a peace plan that he's just putting the finishing touches on. And there have been hints, at least, maybe more explicit than hints, by the president that he may use the leverage that he's obtained in his past interactions with and help to the state of Israel, notably moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, to squeeze the Israelis into some kind of participation in, at least, if not actual assent to the Kushner peace plan, whatever that turns out to be. I've been talking in recent days with people like Itamar Marcus and Harold Rode and others of our friends about the various threats that Israel is facing, whether it's the Palestinian incitement under the Palestinian Authority, or whether it's the fire kites and border activities in Gaza, or whether it's the Iranians and Hezbollah nearing the Golan Heights. This does not seem to be a particularly propitious moment to me, and I'm asking whether it is to you, to be insisting that Israel make territorial concessions to some of these enemies that would weaken them against all of them.
Well, to begin with, nobody's demanded anything of Israel yet. The source of most of the conversation on the peace plan and squeezing Israel comes from the French. The French have their own peace plan. They would like to supplant the United States as the offerer of peace plans because they think they can do better with the Palestinians. They can't.
Shoshana, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There is so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Thank you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're always happy to have with us one of the country's preeminent experts on matters involving immigration policy and specifically threats that arise when our immigration laws are violated. Her name is Jessica Vaughn. These days, she is the Director of Policy Studies for an absolutely indispensable organization, the Center for Immigration Studies. She is, among other things, a former Foreign Service Officer of the United States. She has also been an instructor for senior law enforcement officers in training seminars in places like Illinois. She is a fabulous guest. We're always delighted to have her back. Thank you so much, Jessica, for joining us again.
Hi, Frank. Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. We're very keen to pick your brains about this moment we find ourselves in with a caravan, as it's called, of illegal aliens, at least one. By some counts, there's more than that forming up. The advanced scouts of the first of these is, I gather, they are already at the U.S.-Mexico border, and more will be arriving forthwith. Tell us a little bit about the population of this caravan, as best you can establish it.
It's mostly Hondurans, or at least believed to be mostly Hondurans, with I'm sure some folks from Guatemala joined it as they moved through Guatemala and now moving through Mexico. I'm sure there are Mexicans joining it as well, and also others from other parts of the globe who are making their way along this now well-worn route to the U.S. border. And I say well-worn because we've had a record high number of people coming to the border with families and asking for asylum, and they're coming from all over the world, from Bangladesh, from countries in Africa, as well as countries in Central America. And most of them seem to be from Central America.
Do we have any reason to believe, as the president has insisted, that some of them may be criminals, either from the region or perhaps from the Middle East, people who, as we've discussed on this program a lot, get passports from the Venezuelans but are actually nationals of foreign countries, could be in that mix. Is that something that you have reason to suspect is happening?
Oh, yes. I think we have good reason to believe that there are criminals and gang members and perhaps even people affiliated with terrorist groups within this caravan. And that's because we do know from some media accounts that there have been some people identified who were previously deported from the United States, and more than 90% of the people who are deported from the United States are criminals. And we also know that transnational gangs like MS-13 and 18th Street have been taking advantage of our immigration laws and our, you know, kind of really ineptitude at the border recently to move their new members in to replenish their ranks in the United States. And of course, there have always been smuggling organizations infiltrating these caravans, trying to get people to peel off from them, to, you know, to pay the smugglers to get them in a different way, or maybe while the U.S. border authorities are preoccupied and distracted by a large group of, say, you know, families coming, that's when they get the more dangerous people through while the Border Patrol is, you know, putting car seats in its vans to deal with the families.
The old bait and switch.
Right. And we know that there are some smugglers that specialize in people coming from parts of the world that are associated with terror, like especially Somalia. And the smugglers don't care who they bring. Sometimes, according to some prosecutions that one of my colleagues has studied, they knew that people they were smuggling were terrorists. Sometimes the people working for the smugglers are affiliated with terror groups like Al-Shabaab and others. So this is not a fantasy or a guess. This is something that has already happened, and we should expect that it's happening with this caravan.
The question occurs, do you wish you had a wall now when we're facing this kind of problem? We don't, of course, in most parts of the border. And as a result, President Trump has said he is going to deploy the military to defend our border, to close our border, I think is one way he put it. Jessica Vaughn, you've been in and around government for a long time. Do you have a sense of what the United States military would be expected to do in this circumstance?
Well, yes. I think there are a lot of people wishing there were a wall there right now, because when we used to have thousands of people coming across, that's where we put the triple fence near San Diego, and it works very well. We no longer have large groups of people coming over. So we do need more wall, but we don't have time to build it. We're going to have to use maybe a human wall this time to stop people who think that they can get away with crossing illegally or even through the legal ports of entry. There is a role for the military potentially here. Now, in the past, we have had the National Guard and other units of the military supporting the Border Patrol. They don't have the authority to make immigration arrests normally, but they do help by being a presence and doing things to keep the Border Patrol agents on the line and making arrests. But there is a provision of U.S. law that gives the president the authority to call up not only the military, but also state and local law enforcement agencies and other federal law enforcement agencies like the U.S. Marshals or the FBI or any other badged, a federal agent to help at the border in an immigration emergency or what we call mass migration event. So, and in that case, they would have the authority to make arrests. And something like many people believe that posse comitatus, which prevents the military from being involved in domestic law enforcement, would not apply in a situation like this because we are defending our sovereignty at the borders.
Repelling an invasion, effectively, yeah. And I've also been told that, interestingly enough, I just learned this yesterday, that posse comitatus applies to the Army and the Air Force, but not to the Marine Corps, not to the Navy, of course, but not to the Marine Corps as well. And somebody had made the recommendation, put Marines at the border, not just to avoid the potential problem with posse comitatus's interpretation, but to avoid it altogether. And I'm hearing also, and I don't know if you are, but in addition to the possibility of state governors simply calling up the National Guard in their own right to protect their states against invasion, that there are militia organizations mobilizing to try to provide some, as you say, a human wall, if you will, at the border, especially if the military doesn't, in fact, materialize. So your thoughts on all of this, Jessica? Obviously, the concern that many of us have is that in the process of trying to stop this provocation, this illegal action, there's reason to believe it's not just spontaneous, that it's been organized, it's been encouraged by people who seek to use it for political purposes domestically, but whatever its provenance, that there could be very unconstructive, shall we say, photographic images or video of what happens when the caravan meets the human wall. What are your thoughts on how that should be handled and how to avoid that decided downside risk?
Yes, we've already had those images from what happened when the caravan got to the Mexican border, and they basically just trampled over the barricades that the Guatemalan authorities had put up and streamed into Mexico, and apparently there were Mexican law enforcement agents attacked in that event. And this, you know, should, for anyone who is still under the illusion that this is some kind of spontaneous humanitarian event, that should dispel all of those illusions. This is, as you said, organized, and they are hell-bent on making it to the border and testing our sovereignty and making a political statement for open borders, using all of these people who've joined up along the way as props in that ideological crusade.
A real provocation.
Yeah, absolutely. They'd like to see it. They think that this would work well at the time of a U.S. election. I disagree. I think that the sight of this mob, really, if it amounts to that, at our border, is likely to make voters even more impatient with Congress and raise expectations for President Trump to do something firm, we hear. Now, nobody wants to see violence, and I hope it doesn't come to that at all. I don't think it will. But I do think that it could be very touchy if it comes to it. I hope that they will be dissuaded by this is why the president needs to get out in front of this and perhaps, you know, start preparations at the border now so that people who are in this caravan start to realize that it would be a mistake to continue and only the organizers are left, you know, with trying to provoke U.S. authorities. I don't think we'll take their bait. I think that, you know, we're going to be firm and resolute, and there's no reason whatsoever to let any of these people set foot through either a legal port of entry or set foot. If they do make it through illegally, they have to be immediately detained and returned as quickly as possible.
Even if they claim asylum?
Even if they claim asylum, because it's obvious that if they're involved in this caravan, they've had the opportunity to apply for asylum in Mexico. We can simply just say, look, from now on, we're going to take asylum applications at our embassy in Mexico City, so go apply there.
I appreciate very much your expertise on these matters, Jessica Vaughn, and your thoughtfulness in helping us think through what has to be done about this question of sovereignty and the security of our borders and ultimately the security of our people. Thank you.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Kevin Freeman, a man we have the privilege of speaking with each week on this program and also having as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Kevin is, of course, the best-selling author of Secret Weapon and Game Plan, two extraordinarily important books about a subject in which he is one of the country's experts, economic warfare. This is the topic of his blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and most importantly, his new television production called Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. I've had the privilege of being on it now a couple of times. He is rolling it out on CRTV, the subscription network of Mark Levin and his team. It is an extraordinarily important production. I had the opportunity and the privilege of celebrating it with him and a couple hundred of his friends in Dallas at the launch last weekend. Kevin, so good to have you back. Welcome, and again, congratulations on this wonderful new vehicle for your expertise on matters involving economic warfare and what we have to do to wage it successfully ourselves.
Well, thank you, Frank. Yeah, if anybody interested can go to economicwarroom.com, and there's a free trial and discount.
Wonderful. I commend it to you all. So, Kevin, one of the things that is almost certainly top of your mind, and I think probably most of our listeners, is the state of our stock market. We've had a marvelous run-up in recent months, but it seemed to have hit something of a wall yesterday. Of course, as we speak, the market is open and transactions are taking place. We will be broadcasting this later in the day, and people will know what happened today. But give us a sense of the fundamentals as you see them. We talked a little bit about them with David Goldman at the beginning of the show, but I'd be very interested in your sense of what's affecting the market so dramatically that all of the gains of the year, as I understand it, for the Dow were lost in the course of one trading session yesterday.
Well, we've had a 10-year bull market. The stock market's gone from 6,500 in March of 2009 to over 26,000 at one point, and it's come back since then. President Trump has touted the market's gains as evidence of the success of his policies, and that has not gone unnoticed. Bill Maher, for example, was on his HBO program talking about how he was hoping for a market crash. He wished there anything that would take down Trump. The Chinese, the Russians, and others have discussed this. But I think the markets hit this turbulence mostly because of fear of the midterm elections happening next month.
And what about the midterm elections? Is it the prospect that Republicans might eke out a victory and Donald Trump would be unchecked in moving forward on his nationalist agenda, as they say, or something very much at odds with that?
It's very much at odds with that. I had David Tice, who was the founder and the manager of the Prudent Bear Fund and one of the great stock market investors of our day, and John Malden, who's one of the great analysts of our day, both in the economic war room this past week. And they said that if the Republicans maintain control of the House, which is historically unlikely. During the midterms, the party in power generally loses seats. But if they maintain control of the House, he expects a market melt up. He thinks the market would react favorably. I agree with him. I think that if the Democrats take control, they will immediately rush to impeachment hearings. They will start pushing for socialist policies. They've said all of these things. They want to open the borders, socialist policy. All of these are terrible for the stock market. And this is a national election. It is not an election where you say, well, I like my candidate. He has a D or an R behind his name. You've got to decide who should be running Congress. Is it Maxine Waters and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer? If you believe that, then you vote them in and the stock market will react to that. And I think the reason that we're seeing this indigestion in the markets is a tremendous fear, because if they get control of the House, for example, we will have 24/7 impeachment hearings. It will all be against Trump. It'll be like the Kavanaugh hearings times 100 every day on every cable news outlet, every congressional hearing. And the net result of that is terrible. We had that with Richard Nixon, and of course, the stock market was miserable during that period.
By the way, there's reason to believe, according to Jerry Nadler, who would be, along with Maxine Waters, a committee chairman, in this case, the Judiciary Committee chairman in the House, that they would actually set in train a new investigation of Brett Kavanaugh, quite possibly leading to an effort to impeach him as well. In other words, very much a scorched earth program. And I have to say, you must be right, Kevin, that this would have profound economic effects as well. Kevin, let me turn to something else that has the potential to have profound and very adverse effects. And that is the latest evidence that Communist China has been using technology as a means of obtaining not only proprietary information from defense contractors and competitors in the commercial sector, but even information from individuals using, among other things, a sort of spy chip that they've been putting on to cell phone silicon chips and the like. How serious a problem, as you understand it, is this? The CEO of Apple has denounced this reporting by Bloomberg to the effect that no, it ain't so. What's your assessment, Kevin?
Well, Bloomberg is certainly standing behind the reporting. Apple is claiming that there's no problem here. What it is we manufacture a lot of our semiconductors in China, and they have control of the manufacturing process. And if they wanted to insert a type of malware or something nefarious inside the chip and ship it to us, it would be hard to detect. And once it was detected, would Apple be in a position to say, oh, look, we bought this? That'd be a horrible scandal. So I don't know exactly whether Tim Cook is right or Bloomberg reporters are right, but I know this, that it aligns with the Chinese methodology. It's a part of unrestricted warfare. They have the capability and the opportunity. And so it would be surprising to me had they not tried something. And I believe that they are very active in controlling the supply chain, talking about infiltrating our systems wherever possible. So it is not an unsurprising story. I completely understand why Tim Cook would deny it, and I hope that he is right. I hope against hope that he is right. But this is a very serious risk, and it's something that we have to address. We have enemies of the United States controlling the critical information technology supply chain that is necessary for us to continue in the information economy, and that's a problem.
And this is a problem, it should be said, Kevin Freeman, by you and others who have been warning of this for some time, that it's not only troubling for our economy, but also for our national defense, to the extent that that supply chain may also be feeding into the defense industry and the weapon systems that we deploy. There's, of course, been much concern expressed by the Pentagon and others about Huawei and ZTE, but what you're really saying is if other elements, for example, these chips that are being put into all kinds of equipment wind up migrating into our critical national defense capabilities, that could be, you know, a Trojan horse that would be hugely problematic in time of war, should it be possible or should it be necessary to wage it against China? No?
Oh, absolutely. And we're uncovering even further outside of that form of technology, even in the drug industry. And so we had Rosemary Gibson in the Economic War Room talking about the risks to the drug supply chain. And this is a Chinese policy across the board to become absolutely essential at every critical economic element. And when they do that, then they find our vulnerabilities and they can exploit them.
I spoke earlier again with David Goldman about 5G technology and the prospect that in the very near term, according to some sources, the decision, perhaps irreversible decision, might be made to accede to China's domination of that broadband wireless technology of the future. Your thoughts on that prospect and what we should be doing about it, Kevin?
This is a battle for how are we going to do 5G. All the listeners will remember when there was a battle between Betamax and VHS, between Sony and Panasonic, and which standard would be adopted. And Panasonic's VHS won, and that became the standard. China and the United States are developing different standards of 5G. Essentially, 5G is the next generation of cell phone connectivity.
Kevin Freeman, we'll be following this very closely with you at the Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, of course, at globaleconomicwarfare.com. We'll look forward to talking with you next week, my friend. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.